This podcast is brought to you by the Ethical Society of St. Louis, acting to bring out the best in others and in ourselves. The following recording is of a platform address presented to the Ethical Society of St. Louis by Kate Lovelady, leader of the Ethical Society of St. Louis. Entitled The Ethics of Torture, it was recorded live on 19 October 2008.
And this morning we're going to start by attempting Swedish. Are you ready? God morgon. That's supposedly good morning in Swedish. Someone can tell me afterward how close we were. Well, thank you for coming out on such a beautiful morning for such a depressing topic. My talk today has three main sources: ethical culture leader Joe Schumann's April 2008 paper on torture, a recent collection of essays by Human Rights Watch titled simply Torture, and the PBS documentary Torturing Democracy. Ethical culturists, as I talk about a lot here, aspire to dialogue, but we love debate. The most passionate argument that I've been part of recently at our National Leaders Council occurred this past April, and it came down to two competing words: the versus a. And it sounds Clintonian, but it actually marked quite a profound difference between the following two options. Torture is a most extreme violation of the principles of ethical culture, or torture is the most extreme violation of the principles of ethical torture, of ethical culture, excuse me. And that's kind of where we are now, is discussing, is there such a thing as ethical torture? And why I liked being part of this other argument was that instead of arguing about that, we were trying to determine exactly how atrocious and unethical torture is, which is where I think the argument on torture ought to be in the 21st century. Humans have tortured each other for probably tens of thousands of years and continue to do so today around the globe. Yet over the last 200 years, humanity's ethical evolution has led to national and then international bans on torture by governments and their agents. The 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights bans torture absolutely. The 1949 Geneva Conventions ban cruel treatment and torture. The 1966 International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights states that torture is forbidden even if the life of the nation is threatened. The 1984 Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment explicitly states that no circumstance, no war, no threat, no emergency, no situation, no matter how exceptional, can ever be used by a state to justify torture. The Geneva Conventions refer explicitly to prisoners of war, but these other more recent conventions make no mention of armies and forbid abuse and torture of any and all human beings anywhere, anytime, for any reason, period. And the U.S. has signed every one of these international agreements, and we have cited them to protest abuse and torture in other countries. And then came 9/11. Where the U.S. stands now in relation to torture and international law is based on the argument by some that 9/11 changed everything. The U.S. administration declared that people detained in this war on terror were not soldiers covered by international law, but illegal combatants. This new term for people covered by no laws and possessing no rights. Such people can be detained for any reason, they argued, without charge, a hearing, or legal counsel. They can be held anywhere for any amount of time. They can be treated however the administration felt it needed to treat them. And they had no recourse to any court to try to prove their innocence or protest their treatment. That should be breathtaking. And the Congress has made tut-tut noises, but has largely voted to support the administration's position. The Supreme Court has disagreed, asserting that the constitutional right of habeas corpus, that is the right of a person in custody to protest the legality of their detention, cannot be taken away by the president or Congress or anyone else. So we've had 7 years now of wrangling over whether detainees have even the right to ask the government to show some legal reason for their detention. 7 years during which arguments, both secret and public, have been made that how we are treating these detainees is not torture. And if it is torture, it's not illegal. And if it is illegal, it's justified by national security and public safety. So how is it that we have been treating them? There are minutes from a meeting at Guantanamo Bay Prison that include the quote, "Torture has been prohibited by international law, but the language of the statutes is written vaguely. It is basically subject to perception. If the detainee dies, you're doing it wrong." Whoever made that statement apparently hasn't read any of the international laws on torture. Perhaps instead he or she read the U.S. Department of Justice memos that defied international law by attempting to redefine torture as only acts that result in a risk of organ failure or death. In fact, the Convention Against Torture defines torture as any act by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted on a person for such purposes as obtaining from him information or a confession. But how do we determine if pain and suffering are severe? Some of these interrogation techniques we hear about maybe don't sound quite so bad. I have a suggestion, and it's that as democratic citizens, we should try out techniques on ourselves before we approve of them to be used on other people. So get this. Try this at home. Get a friend, or better yet, your worst enemy. Have this person strip you naked, put a bag over your head, shackle your arms and legs, chain you from the ceiling so that your arms are pulling out of their sockets, and leave you there for a day or two or three. Once you've recovered from that experience, assuming that you do, next have them tie your hands to your ankles and lock you in a tiny, bare, sweltering room with deafening rock music and a strobe light going 24 hours a day. And again, leave you there, stopping by periodically only to make sure that you never fall asleep. Reportedly, sleep deprivation is more painful than starvation. Now, I'm not going to go on in this way, but trust me that those are the mildest possible examples I could find. The techniques that are used in U.S. detention centers are based on North Korean and Soviet practices during the Cold War and Chinese practices during the Korean War, and back then we called them war crimes. Now we call them intelligence gathering. Even if we wanted to, we couldn't correctly simulate even the simple techniques that I described unless we were willing to submit ourselves to them for months and years. There are documented reports of detainees needing to be hospitalized because of the extent of their torture, And as soon as their condition stabilizes, they're sent back to be tortured some more. One of the surest ways to drive a human being insane is to isolate him and to take away all hope. And actually, I would argue that denying habeas corpus is itself torture. What could cause more mental pain and suffering than having no rights, no recourse, not knowing why you've been detained, where you are, whether you will ever get out, whether your family is still alive? Being told that you're going to be shot, that your loved ones have been detained and are being tortured, and having no one to tell you the truth, or even to connect you to reality and the outside world. Most of these detainees come from countries where people routinely disappear. And so it's unlikely that as Americans we can even imagine their fear. The most infamous torture technique currently is, of course, waterboarding, which has euphemistically been called simulated drowning, but in fact is simply drowning, only not to the point of death, usually. You're strapped down and water is poured into a cloth over your face until you begin drowning. Then you're asked a question. Then you're drowned some more until you give an acceptable answer. Personally, I can't imagine any answer that I would not be willing to give under that circumstance. Waterboarding, as practiced by the Japanese, was prosecuted as a war crime after World War II. And just this week, secret memos from 2003 and 4 have surfaced from the U.S. administration that gave the CIA approval to waterboard detainees. So I've mentioned just a very few of the things that we are doing to detainees, but who are they? They've ranged in age from 13 to 90 years old. The label illegal combatants suggests that they were all picked up while committing terrorist acts. Some were fighters picked up during the war in Afghanistan. Some were swept up in raids of alleged Al-Qaeda members and supporters. Many were turned in by bounty hunters. The U.S. distributed leaflets in Afghanistan, which is one of the poorest countries in the world and filled with competing groups. Leaflets asking people to turn in Al-Qaeda and Taliban members in return for enough money to take care of your family and village for the rest of your life. Of the over 700 prisoners who passed through Guantanamo, the vast majority either have been or eventually will be released without charges. Without charges, apologies, or compensation for the years lost and the abuse and torture suffered. Now, we tend to be a pragmatic utilitarian bunch, so I wanted to mention that aside from torture being illegal, there are many practical reasons why we shouldn't torture people. Torture yields false information. It undermines our international standing. It loses hearts and minds and creates more terrorists. It weakens international law and therefore endangers people all over the world, including our own soldiers. I could expand on all these points, but I wanted to get to the ticking bomb scenario. What about that ticking bomb? Even if we acknowledge that torture is illegal and has lots of bad consequences for us, must we forbid it absolutely? What if there were a bomb about to go off and the only way to save everyone was to torture that terrorist into telling us where the bomb was? Don't we need to leave a loophole in the law so that we can torture someone when we really, really have to in order to save lives? No. And here's why not. First, ticking bombs are interesting moral hypotheticals, but they're only hypothetical. An Israeli legal scholar pointed out the perfect storm of circumstances that would need to exist for a ticking bomb scenario to be a justification for torture. We would have to know beyond a reasonable doubt that a bomb actually existed, that it would go off, that it would go off before any other way of finding it could be used, that it would kill innocent people, that the person we were going to torture knew where it was, that it hadn't been moved in the meantime, that the person would tell us the truth, that he or she would tell us in time, that we would be able to disarm it, and so on and so forth. But to my mind, even more impossibly hypothetical is a government and a system that could keep in place adequate safeguards to keep ticking bomb loopholes from widening until they included almost anyone. Governments have tried to allow only emergency torture, and the result has always been widespread abuse and widespread torture. The ticking bomb exception is inevitably a slippery slope once we decide that torture is allowable so long as it's the lesser of two evils. After all, given all the difficulties of getting to and disarming a bomb, or the possibility that it could go off early, if it's okay to torture someone if a bomb is to go off soon, it's logically also okay to torture someone if a bomb is to go off not so soon, or even while the bombing is still in the planning stage. We've been torturing people allegedly connected to 9/11 and the bombing of the USS Cole after those events had already occurred, because there might be other bombs, or other plans, or other thoughts about plans. The AP reported that the U.S. waterboarded Al-Qaeda detainees based on, quote, widespread belief among U.S. intelligence officials that more catastrophic events will be imminent, unquote. That sounds like the kind of vague belief that will be widespread for a long time. What exactly is imminent, and what exactly is catastrophic? The likelihood of the perfect ticking bomb scenario occurring is so great. The likelihood of the perfect ticking bomb scenario occurring is so remote, and what is so great is the likelihood of limited torture spreading, that an absolute ban is the only ethical solution. And that's also why an absolute ban is international law. Again, the Convention Against Torture states no exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether a state of war or threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency may be invoked as a justification for torture. Americans like to think that we're exceptional. 9/11 was a hideous, horrifying, tragic event. But it was really not that exceptional. And many other countries have suffered much worse. And yet, they haven't decided to throw out international law. So what gives us the right? As you can tell, I really don't like the ticking bomb scenario very much. And not just because extreme hypotheticals make bad law. I suspect that we fixate on this imaginary scenario to avoid looking at why we really torture. Torture has been studied for thousands of years. And no matter the claims, torture is not primarily about extracting information or keeping us safe. It's about punishment and domination, contempt, and intimidation. It's an attempt to transfer our pain and fear to someone whom we blame for it. We torture our enemies to emphasize our strength and their weakness, to prove that they are animals, not human like we are, that humans could not do the things that they have supposedly done. The commander in charge of Abu Ghraib called the detainees dogs and said that they should be made to feel no better than dogs all the time. Dogs are generally treated much better than they were, I'm glad to say, for dog's sake. Torture is a form of counterterrorism. We seek to strike fear into our enemies, although, as I've said, we're more likely to recruit new ones instead. And it's a form of public relations. Torture reassures the public that everything is being done in the war on terror. Neither law, nor conscience, nor mercy will be allowed to stand in the way of our vengeance and our safety. What more could we ask than that? Do we want human beings tortured just to make us feel better? Maybe we do. A lot of us want human beings executed to make us feel better. It doesn't help to pretend that we don't have primitive desires for violence and vengeance. We do. I do. We also invented law to counter our primitive impulses. I strongly suspect that the ticking time bomb scenario is not a logical argument so much as a last-ditch attempt to justify something that we desire. We desire to punish and cause pain to the bad guys. We fear terrorism and we need to feel safe. And we need to acknowledge that these needs and fears are strong and that they'll lead us astray if we're not vigilant about asserting our higher values. If you will, close your eyes and imagine that ticking bomb scenario for a moment. Just a flash, a picture. Whom does your imagination cast in the role of terrorist? Probably a tough Arab-looking man, the kind who would be cast as the terrorist in a movie. Yet Al-Qaeda has recruited all sorts of people integrated in communities. People have been charged with joining Al-Qaeda when they were 8 years old. What if the person we have in custody, who likely knows where that ticking bomb is in that perfect scenario, is an 8-year-old boy? What if it's an old woman? What if it's a pregnant 17-year-old? If we are good utilitarians, we should be as comfortable imagining their torture as we are with the movie version. But I'm guessing that many of us are not so comfortable. And that should tell us something about why we really want to torture. The underlying reasons we torture also explain why it's not possible to create systems that allow for torture-light interrogation techniques. Such techniques inevitably degenerate into abuse and torture. Whether by encouraging interrogators to push the envelope of the law or requiring torture warrants. Once a culture of dehumanization and punishment is created, it spreads and it worsens. Justifications for the next step down the slippery slope are always found, or they're invented. Judges are pressured into providing whatever warrants are requested, because they don't want to be blamed if more terrorist attacks occur. A system that tried to allow vigorous interrogation up to but not crossing the line of torture would require an extraordinary commitment to accountability, a commitment that no government in the world seems to have. And in our own case, we need look no farther than Abu Ghraib and the refusal to investigate higher up the chain of command to know that we don't have it. So after our argument last April, the National Leaders Council finally approved the following statement, which was adopted by the National Assembly of Ethical Societies. The use of torture is the most extreme violation of the principles to which ethical culture is dedicated. Among these principles, respect and reverence for the dignity of the human being is foremost. With the emergence of torture as a component of American policy in the war on terror, ethical culture calls for the absolute and total ban on the use of torture as defined in the Convention Against Torture, whether by the military, law enforcement, intelligence services, or private actors. Which brings us back to the debate over the versus a. How can we say that torture is worse than, say, murder? And we can say that because our position focuses in on our ethical humanist foundational ideal of positive human relating and its extreme opposite. From the ethical standpoint, torture is the most extreme violation of human dignity because torture is the complete perversion of positive human relating. Torture annihilates the freedom of its victims, and not just physical freedom, which society can choose to limit for the sake of public safety, but even freedom of thought and choice, as torture eradicates rational thought and feeling and removes by force the free will of its victim. Torture is arguably a greater violation of dignity than murder, as the goal of torture is to make another person's life as debased, terrorized, and painful as human ingenuity can devise. Torture also debases not only its victims, but its perpetrators. And we forget this. To ask our agents to ethically debase themselves in order to keep us safe is far more unethical to my mind than asking them to die with honor for the safety of our country. And torture not only debases, but also causes suffering to the people who have to do this torturing. Much of the post-traumatic stress, other psychological trauma, and even increased rates of suicide that we've seen among our soldiers returning from Afghanistan and Iraq are the results of the abuse and torture that they've seen and engaged in. So ethical humanists like to debate, as I said, and we like to look at issues from all sides, and that's good. But in the case of torture, rather than look for ways to justify it or to push the boundaries between legal interrogation and torture, let us be part of the movement that seeks to push the boundaries of human dignity. Let's move the discussion forward, past when and how it's okay to torture if we really, really, really need to, to whether torture is as ethically unjustifiable as murder or worse. For my final word, I'd just like to thank this society's Ethical Action Committee for endorsing the Ban Torture Campaign of Veterans for Peace. And as usual, I'll be downstairs in the library after platform. I had to cut about half of what I wanted to say this morning, but don't let that frighten you, because I actually want to hear what you have to say. Thank you.
You have been listening to a platform address presented to the Ethical Society of St. Louis by Kate Lovelady, leader of the Ethical Society of St. Louis, on 11 October 2008. To discuss this address, please join in our community forum at www.live.ethicalstl.org. To hear other lectures, to learn more about our society or about the ethical culture movement, please visit our website at www.ethicalstl.org. Until next time, thank you for listening.